Today on CyberWork, I'm very, very happy to be speaking to Sam King, CEO of Veracode. Sam is an icon in the realms of secure coding and application security, and she took time to speak with both me and InfoSec CEO Jack Koziel about her own cybersecurity journey, the president's directive on software security, and so, so many more topics. You really, really don't want to miss this one, folks. It's all coming your way on CyberWork. First, I want to point your attention to an all-new ebook published by InfoSec. It's titled Developing Cybersecurity Talent and Teams, and it's free to read if you just go to infosecinstitute.com/ebook. It collects practical team development ideas for industry leaders, including professionals from Raytheon, KPMG Cyber, Booz Allen, NICE, JPMorgan Chase, and more. Did I mention it's free? Well, it is. Just go to infosecinstitute.com/ebook. Go get your copy and start learning today. And now, without further ado, let's begin the show. Welcome to this week's episode of the CyberWork with InfoSec podcast. Each week, we talk with a different industry thought leader about cybersecurity trends, the way those trends affect the work of InfoSec professionals, and offer tips for breaking in or moving up the ladder in the cybersecurity industry. Sam King is the Chief Executive Officer of Veracode and a recognized expert in cybersecurity, DevSecOps, and business management. A founding member of Veracode, Sam has played a significant role in the company's growth trajectory over the past 15 years, helping to mature it from a small startup to a company with a $1 billion-plus valuation. Under her leadership, Veracode has been recognized with several industry distinctions, including a 7-time consecutive leader in the Gartner Magic Quadrant, leader in the Forrester SaaStwave, and a Gartner Peer Insights Customer Choice for Application Security. Sam has been a keynote speaker at events such as Gartner's Security Summit, RSA, and the Executive Women's Forum on topics ranging from cybersecurity to empowering women and creating diverse and resilient corporate cultures. She's been profiled in business publications such as the Huffington Post, CNN Money, Financial Times, InfoSecurity Magazine, and the Boston Globe. Sam received her Master's of Science and Engineering in Computer and Information Science from the University of Pennsylvania. She earned her BS in Computer Science from University of Strathclyde in Glasgow, Scotland, where she earned the prestigious Charles Babbage Award, awarded to the student with the highest academic achievement in the graduating class. She currently sits on the board of Progress Software and is also a member of the Board of Trustees for the Massachusetts Technology Leadership Council, where she was a charter member of the 2030 Challenge, a tech compact for social justice in efforts to bring more diversity to the local workforce. And also joining me today, InfoSec CEO and founder, Jack Koziel. Hi, Jack. How you doing?
Doing great, Chris. Great to be on your show again.
And Sam, thank you very much for being our guest today on CyberWork. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
Jack and I both had some questions for Sam today, but I'd like to start with where we start all of our interviews, which is we'd like to learn a little bit about Sam's experience and personal journey in cybersecurity. So Sam, your background in computer and tech goes back a long, long way, including master's in computer science and even before that. So clearly your love of computers and tech have been with you for a long time. When did you first know that computers and security was the thing you wanted to do with your life? And what was the initial draw?
Yeah, so I have been in computers and technology for a long time. And I think it was actually my high school in India, where I grew up, where, to be totally honest, the only room in my high school that had air conditioning was the computer room.
Oh.
And that was the initial draw, is that sure. For some time period, I get to be in an air conditioned room.
Yeah.
And computers seemed kind of cool. So I signed up for the computer class, got to spend some time out of the heat in an air conditioned room, which was very nice. And as I learned more about the subject, it really intrigued me. The possibilities of what you can do with this technology really intrigued me. And so that's how I got my start in computers. And I chose to pursue a degree in computer science, which then led to another degree in computer science. And once I got my master's, I really was very ready to put that to real work. And so then I got a job as a consultant doing systems integration projects for a lot of our clients. And then the move to security came later, several years into my career in technology. And this was right around 2000, 2001. Somebody that I had worked with had gone on to found a security company, and they hired me at that security company, and I previously had no knowledge of what security was all about, but it seemed like an interesting field. And so I joined that company and here we are.
I always think of that sort of era of security as still being kind of the Wild West in terms of it seems like the career and the position and the process of it was kind of being built all around you. Like, what was it like to be on the ground floor of something that people really didn't give all that much thought to in the same way before that?
You know, I have to say, when I first moved from this systems integration firm that I was working for to a security company, the cultural difference between the two was so stark and almost a little overwhelming. And here's what I mean. When, you know, by the time I left my systems integration consulting company, I had moved into project management and we were developing e-commerce web applications for customers and, you know, a lot of retail companies that were getting into e-commerce at that time and so on. And, you know, it was all about creativity. It was about getting out functionality fast, having an engaging user experience. We didn't really talk or know much about security, right? We were all about delivering amazing experiences through these e-commerce platforms and these applications on behalf of the customers that we were serving. And occasionally, right as we were getting ready to deliver the project to the customer, someone might say, hey, has security been taken care of? And, you know, we're like, sure. Yes. What do you mean by that? Right.
And as long as there's no follow-up questions. Yes.
Right. And so we weren't educated on the topic. And so when this person that I knew started this company and reached out to me to see if I would be interested in joining, I was like, you know, security is this thing that people are starting to ask questions about. It's probably going to be important, but I don't really know what it is about. So let me go experience that. And then when I joined this security company, there were some phenomenally experienced information security professionals that had come up through the compliance and risk management ranks. Mm. I think this was still a little bit before you saw sort of mainstream developers and technologists move into security. This was more the realm of compliance and risk management at that time still. Mm-hmm. And, you know, their considerations were so different than the developers that I was hanging out with. Their considerations were managing risk, and they were always planning out all the scenarios in which things could go wrong. Meanwhile, you know, we were talking about how do we make the web application and the website more engaging. And like the conversations were totally different. And so that's what I mean by a really stark cultural difference between what was top of mind for the people that were creating these applications. And then when I started to hang out with the people that were concerned about security.
Hmm. Yeah. Now, like you were saying that, like, you know, these were all sort of new concerns at the time. And, you know, and you're sort of swimming in this sort of soup of like, you know, let's all just figure this out on the fly. Can you think of like some specific moments where you like finished a certain project or did, you know, implemented a certain process where you're like, okay, this is starting to come together into like a real, into a real process. Do you have like stepping stone moments like that where you said,
well,
oh, I really like doing this.
I'll tell you about probably the first official conversation I had with a customer in after officially joining an information security, cybersecurity company. Mm-hmm. At which point I have to admit, I did not know really anything about security, right? But I happened to get left alone with a customer, and the project that I was going to be managing was to develop an incident response plan for this customer. And, you know, I had read the briefing before I went to the meeting. So of course I had some sense for what we're talking about here and what the customer's concerns are. And, you know, the person said to me, so how do you go about developing this incident response plan? And I was thinking, boy, I wish they had asked me this question when my colleague, who's a little more knowledgeable than I am at this moment, was also in the room. But, you know, I had come from a consulting background, so I thought I'll take a shot at this. And I said to them, listen, today's technically my first day on the job, but here's more or less what we're going to look to do. We're going to try to first understand what your concerns are in this regard. What does your current state look like with you know, what do you consider to be an incident? How do you respond to it? Where do you believe the gaps are? We're going to go talk to your key stakeholders in the company. Who else gets involved in this process, right? And then we'll develop a point of view on this is what your current state looks like. This is what your objectives are in terms of developing a better incident response plan. And we will come back with some recommendations and some approaches on how you can close the gap between your present state and where you'd like to be. And we'll take, you know, various constituencies, concerns, considerations, desires into account as we do this. And we'll stay closely connected with you as we go through this process. They're like, that sounds great. And I thought, okay, maybe I can do this security thing. Because ultimately what I realized was, you know, while it feels like this dark, mysterious art, especially to people that were new to security at the time, right. And there's this body of knowledge and, you know, regulations and compliance and terminology and all of these things and jargon that sits behind it, at the end of the day, it's a business problem. You're trying to meet a business need for an organization. It happens to be to manage risk. In this case, it was how do you respond to an incident in a right. way that, you know, keeps the organization functioning and so on. And so if you approach it from that perspective, okay, you can learn the domain while you continue to help meet the business requirements that customers have.
Yeah, that's got to be exciting and really feel like you've sort of broken through to something new. Jack, did you have any sort of similar things happen in those sort of Wild West days where you felt like you had sort of like broken through and, you know, figured this stuff out in, you know, in a way that you hadn't expected before?
Yeah, I mean, my whole career and before my career was in cyber, so it wasn't even called that then. I mean, you know, it wasn't even really a profession, I think, when I got into it, you know, you know, never really kind of had that realization. But, you know, I was just curious, Sam, like, was there a point when you realized that this was an industry that was going to grow and become, you know, what it is today, where you have the president of the United States repeatedly talking about cybersecurity is a top national concern? I mean, I feel like earlier in my career, you know, it was something that nobody, I had to explain to people what I did, and nobody really understood what it was. And, you know, my first boss, when I was working at a bank, he told me there'll never be more than one technical security, information security person at the bank. You know, there's not gonna be much of a career here for you. If you want to advance or do anything else, so you better think of some career options, kid. So right. I don't know if there was like an inflection point in your career where you were like, wow, this is really something. I mean, this industry is going to grow.
Yeah, you know, I would say that first year after I joined the cybersecurity company was instructive for me, because when I first joined that company, like I said, it was a pretty stark difference in just the culture and the considerations that were top of mind of the people that you were working with, right? Like, I felt like I'd gone from the world of creating technology to now the world of like protecting ourselves in the context of those technology platforms. And it felt very different. And it took a while to sort of bridge that gap. And honestly, we continue to work today to bridge that gap between people that are creating technology and people that have responsibility for securing technology. But over the course of that year, what I learned was, look, we are going to keep making use of more and more technology. There's going to be more software in the world, more applications in the world. We are going to be more connected than we've been in the past. And just on the basis of the growth that we were seeing in our own business, you could tell that this was going to stay a problem for some time. And therefore, this was going to stay an area of need for some time, right? And so I think when I first joined, like the first, you know, 30 days, I'm trying to figure out what is this security thing and how does one be successful at it. And by the end of that first year, I had had enough interactions with both security professionals, people that had, you know, CISSPs and other degrees and accreditations in security, and customers that didn't know anything about security, to know that there's a need here and that we're going to need talented people to go fulfill on that need.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, I wanted to, you know, we were very excited, of course, to get Sam as a guest today because, you know, Veracode is certainly an incredibly well-respected and you know, very much talked about company. And we really wanted to get your insights, and we're really so glad you could be here today. So to start with, I wanted to sort of talk about what some of the initiatives, projects, or changes you've implemented with Veracode as CEO that you're the most proud of and things that you're excited to talk about with Veracode in 2021 here.
Yeah. So, well, the first thing that I'll say that we're really proud of is in your intro, Chris, you had said that we are leaders in the Magic Quadrant 7 years in a running. Well, right. Actually, it's 8 now. So right. We were named as a leader in the Magic Quadrant again when the Magic Quadrant was released just a couple of weeks ago.
Congratulations.
So that is some, thank you. That is something we're very proud of as a team, to be a leader 8 years in a running. And, you know, recently I was speaking with the CISO of a large healthcare organization, and I was describing to them that we've been named leaders eighth year in a running. And, you know, the comment that they made to me was, a lot of times what you see in our industry is you see companies come into the picture, have some very innovative technology, really capitalize on it. But then as they get to some degree of scale, that innovative spirit maybe becomes less strong, and maybe you start taking what you're doing for granted a little bit, and you see right. people slip, right? And so to stay in that leadership position over 8 years is something that we take very seriously and we're proud of. And it's just a great testament to how dedicated our team is to the mission of software security, which everyone at Veracode really, really cares about. And it's just an absolute privilege to work with that team every single day. So, you know, that's something that we're very proud of. And then if I think about 2021, Jack, you were saying, you know, did you think that the president of the United States would have a document around cybersecurity? Were you thinking about that when you joined security? Probably not. But I was also not really thinking that a document that is from the president's office will have words like static analysis, dynamic analysis, and software composition analysis either, right? And yet those words are present, and something like 25% of the executive order is devoted to this topic of software supply chain security. So, you know, the thing that our team gets very excited about is that a topic that we have been driving awareness around for years since our founding in 2006, and our founder, Chris Weissopel, since even prior to that, and a topic that we've been studying and supporting people in for that period is now getting broad-based attention. And a statement is being made that this is important. It's of existential importance because our lives are playing out in the digital sphere more than anywhere else, especially given what we've gone through this last year. And therefore, this is something that is going to be taken seriously. And the way that the federal government is going to approach their software procurement invariably is going to create a little bit of a domino effect, we believe, in how organizations in general start to think about what kind of software they're using, where is it coming from, how, whether the providers have done diligence on security, and so on and so forth. So I think this is a very exciting moment in time where there's this confluence of everything becoming digital and this big recognition in light of what has happened that this is important, that this is a piece of the fabric of our digital lives that we have to shore up better. And so for us, you know, we think of this as really, you're going from sort of application security to software security. And what do I mean by that? Like, it used to be that you could draw really clean lines around what an application is, right?
Yeah.
And now we use APIs and we use open source code, and you got containers and you have infrastructure as code, where code's being used to articulate what kind of infrastructure you want to have, right? Configurations you want to have. And we think that it really is about bringing security to software in whatever form it presents itself and making it easy and easy for developers to use, but not forgetting about the needs of the security team either. Because I think what I learned on day one in this space is still true today, which is that there are multiple constituencies that come into the picture when you're talking about a topic like cybersecurity, when you're talking about software security. You've got developers that are creating it. You've got the open source community that creates so much software that gets so much reuse. And then you have security and compliance people, and now businesses and boards that have to attest to the security of the software they're producing. So we're really excited about thinking about how do we take what we have been doing and just keep showing up in places where developers and code is, and making it so easy for people to integrate this into their software development lifecycle that if this is the right thing to do and it's the easy thing to do, why wouldn't you do it? And oh, by the way, now the federal government is going to require that you do it too, right, if you want to sell to them. So that's the opportunity that lies ahead for us that gets us very excited.
Yeah, speaking to the executive report, I mean, you know, pardon me if I sort of contextualize this a little bit. We have some you know, listeners who are just sort of getting their feet wet in cybersecurity. But to contextualize, you wrote an open letter to the Boston Business Journal, and you said of the recent executive order on cybersecurity that, quote, the recent Colonial Pipeline hack, which had a severe impact on the day-to-day lives of citizens across many states in the U.S., is evidence enough that the nation's approach to cyber defense needs improvement, and urgently so. You also noted that, quote, the executive order is finally shining a light on the software development process, as you just said, and highlighting how building security directly into the software development lifecycle, you know, or not, has far-reaching effects. And the administration is making clear that it is time to strengthen our standards on cybersecurity and step up our collective secure software development process. Obviously, said this is a transformative moment. Can we talk a little bit about the order itself? What are your thoughts on the language and scope of it? Do you think it went far enough? It could have gone farther, or is it just the fact that it's out there is worthwhile enough?
So I think the fact that it's out there is incredibly worthwhile. It's been a long time coming.
Yes.
Our founder, Chris Weissopel, I think it was 23 years ago that he testified in front of Congress when he was part of the think tank Loft to talk about the risks associated with the internet at large and you know, technology more broadly speaking. And so 8 years after that, he started Veracode and I joined him, and we've been talking about this topic for a long time. So for those of us that have been in this space, I think it's been a long time coming, but the fact that it is here is, I think, a noteworthy event for sure. Now, I see it as in process, and here's what I mean by that. The executive order calls on NIST, as an example, to develop more detailed standards around software supply chain security. And it calls on other bodies to develop standards and procedures and protocols around other things that are mentioned in the executive order, right? The creation of an institution similar to the Transportation Safety Board, as an example, for cybersecurity, right?
Right.
The concept of how do you think about labeling for software the way you think about labeling for other goods that we consume on a, you know, daily basis, right?
Sure.
How do you think about verifying software? I think these are all ideas, great ideas that have been surfaced as part of this executive order, but that the full definition of these ideas is going to be carried forward through those organizations, NIST being one of them that is named in there. I also think that calling out the fact that this is going to take partnership between the public sector, the private sector, and academia is really important, right? Because we've got people across multiple realms of the, you know, world that we're in approaching cybersecurity in different ways. You've got people that work in government agencies in the US or anywhere else that have the mission of their agency. You've got private organizations that may be for-profit or nonprofit that have the mission of their organization that you're pursuing. You have academia that is interested in studying this topic more deeply and training the future technologists on what they should be doing from a security standpoint. So I think bringing about these multiple players in the cybersecurity space together to then put together our best practices and come up with what the standard should be that we should adopt moving forward, I think is another really good call for this to make. So we are, you know, working with these organizations to share what we've learned over the years doing this for 15 plus years here. And what are some of the best practices that we have come upon that we can share with everybody else that they can take advantage of. So, you know, I think that the fact that this has come about is a strong statement. I think we are going to see it take full definition as these other organizations do the work that's been called upon for them to do.
Right. And I think that comes down to, you know, that's the sort of, you know, the test of any strong statement like that is whether people actually implement on it or actually, you know, do their part of it.
Exactly.
Sam, you know, you kind of touched on it a little bit there, a little curious. You mentioned licensing or labeling of software. Are you proposing that you think the federal government should be doing some sort of labeling or licensing of software when it comes to security? Do you think that's a,
no, that's
a role? Or
what I'm getting at is, you know, when, so we have this program, for example, that we call Verified at Veracode, where the Verified program will work with software providers and will take a look at what are the software development methodologies they're using with respect to security, how are they testing their applications, what kinds of tests are they adopting, what is their policy around, what does good look like from a security standpoint, so that then we can say, we have looked at this organization, this application, and we are giving them the Verified status, because what that conveys to us is that they're taking these aspects of secure software development seriously. They have these kinds of policies in place and so on and so forth. And that provides a degree of assurance, right? That provides a degree of assurance to the person that is buying that software. And really what I found is that for those that are looking to sell their software, it becomes a business requirement to demonstrate to the people that want to buy that software that they take security seriously and that they have taken the necessary steps to ensure that the software that they're delivering to them meets those standards. And so there's almost a commercial motivation to go do that. And so I don't think that we necessarily need like a body that goes and does this, but I think the fact that we are raising awareness to say, look, software is getting consumed in prolific ways, and there should be this understanding between people that are producing software, people that are consuming software, as to what you're getting and what does the, what do the practices around the development of that software look like? I think that in and of itself is going to create the motivation for these organizations to go do more in this area.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting take. I mean, so privately, you know, private company can provide their label, but, you know, I always think like, you know, a toy company can't sell a toy that like electrifies children and fundamentally fails. You know, there's Underwriters Lab, there's, you know, Consumer Protection Bureau, there's all these things out there, but you can sell a router that is fundamentally flawed and someone can go plug that into a bank or a hospital or whatever. You know, I feel like there should be some government oversight in this to some degree. I don't know what the right answer is there, but.
Yeah, and I think what's emerging, if you look at the executive order, is, and especially if you think about the standards that are going to be created here, is if you can create a standard of this is what good looks like, and then someone can give you assurance that I adhere to that standard, that's good, right? Because we've stipulated to the fact that the standard is good, and I can demonstrate to you that the practices that I follow and, you know, this particular application meets these standards, that gives you a degree of comfort around, you know, what you're buying. Now, software doesn't stay still, right? You're constantly, you've got a new release and you know, it's constantly evolving, constantly changing. So this is not a one and done. That's why both the practices that you're using for your software development lifecycle, as well as what you can attest to for any given piece of code, a combination of those two things is important. By the way, what is also important is equipping the people that are creating the software, our developers, with the right knowledge and the right tools to do this, right? Because the best form of prevention is to not have that vulnerability get into the code to begin with. So let's go tell them what good looks like. And developers have pride of ownership. They will write better code when we train them on that.
Where do you draw the line between what languages and frameworks should be doing in terms of security and third-party security assessment, static analysis, dynamic analysis tools should be doing, and then what should just be developer skill in terms of secure coding ability? I mean, how do you... I think that's something that many organizations struggle with is where to draw those lines.
Yeah. So, you know, I think the developer skills piece to me is a pretty basic piece, right? Where I feel like if you're an organization that is writing code that's going to be used for a critical process, that's going to transact critical data, that for your organization provides any kind of an attack surface, you want to make sure that the developers that are creating that code have the right skill set around how to write secure code, right? And so I think that that's a pretty fundamental thing. It's amazing to me that, you know, I have earlier we talked about the fact that I had 2 degrees in computer science, and I got those degrees a while back, but I don't have a single course in my both the bachelor's or master's curriculum that talked to me about how to write secure code. Now, that is changing. A lot of university programs are incorporating how to write secure code. We've done our part here. We actually did a program called Hacker Games where we ran a contest for 8 universities across the US and the UK, and developers of the future, we gave them the opportunity to come in and compete with each other on who can find and fix the most vulnerabilities over a certain time period. We gave $15,000 in charitable donations to the institutions of the organizations that won. So we did all of that because we believe that equipping developers with the right skill set and the right knowledge is pretty fundamental. And we should do that, frankly, as part of our educational curriculums, but if not, certainly as these developers start their professional careers, right? And then there's the concept of trust but verify, right? So how much should a language or a framework innately have? To a certain extent, you know, that's going to be dependent on the developers of those languages and frameworks. And to say that everyone is much more aware of what kind of security vulnerabilities continue to persist even when you go to newer languages, right? I think everyone knows that. And so as awareness around that increases, you would expect that as people come out with new frameworks, new languages, they're keeping security in mind in the way they are thinking about architecting it. But at the same time, just because that's the case, you still have to verify what actually came to be in this piece of code when this piece of open source code got combined with that custom code, you know, which calls into that API, which then gets put into a container and gets deployed over there, you know, in my AWS infrastructure, et cetera. So I don't think that it's any one thing. It's a combination of these things because there's the core skill set of people that write the code. There's the awareness and responsibility that people that are creating these technology platforms are increasingly having as a result of what we're living through. And then there is the verification process. Let's make sure that as multiple pieces of code came together, that we can attest to the security of that.
That folds nicely into your Veracode, you know, released its state of application security report recently, which, you know, as you expect, had some concerning info, but also suggested the state of AppSec was maybe moving in the right direction. So 74% of apps were found to have some sort of flaw, but less than 25% had critical flaws, and less than 5% were flaws that could be actively exploited, if I'm reading that right. So does that fit in at all with your findings? Or do you feel that people, that things are moving in the right direction, and will this, you know, obviously this executive order will probably shine more light on the importance of these sorts of things?
Yeah, so I think the executive order is important, don't get me wrong. We talked mm-hmm. earlier about the fact that it makes a bold statement. I think that some of the good progress that's been made around software security, frankly, precedes the executive order. I think sure. The move to DevOps, a lot of people were concerned around, hey, as we move to DevOps, that could mean that more insecure code just gets deployed faster now, yeah. right? like right. We're increasing speed of code delivery and we're just going to deliver
we're
more
faster
insecure
and worse
code. What's going to happen with this, right? And yeah. And what I started to see was a very interesting shift where it used to be that you would do security testing late in the development lifecycle. You're ready to deploy right. the code. Then someone from security comes around and says, hey, wait a minute, you can't deploy it. We got to test it. You test it, you find a bunch of issues, then you go back and you say, oh, sorry, we can't deploy it. We got to go fix those issues. It's right. frustrating for the security team. It's frustrating for the developers, yeah. so on and so forth, right? And so then you started to see security teams saying, okay, let's integrate security testing into the software development lifecycle. Right when a developer is writing a line of code, they're in their IDE, what can we do there? Then CI/CD pipeline comes together, what can we do there? So that you discover these problems earlier, right? Mm-hmm. And you're not discovering these problems pre-deployment at such a late stage when everyone is stressed out and it creates a negative experience for everyone.
Sure.
And that was certain, that is the way that we've professed you do it too, right? You scan early, you scan often. NIST has data that they've put out over the years where it's 30 times less expensive to find and fix these vulnerabilities earlier in the development lifecycle than if you're tackling something in production. So all of that makes sense. But the interesting thing that I saw with the move to DevOps is DevOps was a movement that was getting adoption and a lot of momentum behind it inside development organizations, and wasn't necessarily something that the security teams had created or were pushing, right? That like it was gaining momentum in and of itself inside development organizations, because what development organizations realized was that we want to have efficiency and better operations of this code when it's going to run in production. And so we want to break these silos between development and operations.
Right.
And I think that therein was an opportunity for the security team to say, if we're going to go and change our practices and our philosophies around how we think of developing and deploying code, then why don't we also include security as part of those new practices that we're coming out with? So I personally saw DevOps turn into DevSecOps or SecDevOps or whatever combination of those three things you want to call it.
Right.
I saw that transition occur quite quickly, at least from a philosophical standpoint, which is that DevOps shouldn't really be DevOps. It should be DevSecOps. If we're going to go change the way we develop and deploy code, let's also plug security in at the same time. And I think that was a great opportunity. So even before the executive order came out, which is now saying, look, this is a matter of existential importance, I think there was a movement afoot in the world of technology and the world of development that already was creating a really good vehicle for security to get plugged in and acceleration of security testing, right?
Yeah.
So now coming back to the State of Software Security report that you were referencing, I mean, we've definitely seen progress over the years. 25% of applications having a critical flaw is a number that is better than what we used to see in the early days. And I think it's because there's been, 15 plus years of awareness around the types of vulnerabilities that will get you in trouble, that can be highly exploited, training around those, and so on and so forth. And then the other thing that we see is, okay, so that's good that those numbers are coming down. It still takes people several months to fix these vulnerabilities and reduce the backlog of these vulnerabilities. So what can we do to improve that, right? One thing that we've already talked about is education. So the better educated the developer community is on security, they're going to write better code. You're going to have fewer things to fix to begin with, right? So I think that's becoming increasingly important. But then there are certain practices as well that we've found to see a positive correlation with the amount of time it takes to fix. If you're scanning frequently, which really means that you've plugged this into your development lifecycle, into your CI/CD pipeline, it's part of how code gets written and deployed, it's going to take you 3 weeks less to fix half of the vulnerabilities that are discovered than if you were scanning infrequently. So frequent scanning is a good practice to adopt, right?
Yeah, and it doesn't add more time. It takes time off and
takes time off. Exactly.
Ultimately more efficient. Yeah, because I think that
ultimately makes you more efficient.
Yeah.
If you have a more mature program where you have multiple testing techniques that you are bringing to bear, half of these flaws you'll fix 24 days faster is I think what we'd report, right? So because you're looking at it in multiple ways, it gives you more assurance around, yes, this really matters and I have to go fix this and this one is manageable perhaps, right? It makes it more pragmatic. And automation matters. If you have, if you are doing this in an automated fashion where you have part of your build process, you call into these testing technologies, it could be static, it could be whatever it is, and you've got this tightly plugged in such that a developer doesn't have to take a manual step to go do this, you've automated this, that's also going to cause you to fix these vulnerabilities faster. So it's not just that you find them in a more efficient way, it actually helps with the outcome of getting to secure software.
Right. Yeah. And I imagine a lot of it is just sort of reticence about changing the way you've always done it or whatever. If you hear, this is going to actually make your software safer and faster and more efficient, like you would think that people would be like breaking down the doors to sort of make the change. But I imagine there's just a lot of,
there is. And I think this is where the concept I was talking about earlier around, building a bridge between the development organization and the security organization is really important. So like one of the things that we talk to customers about a lot and encourage as we work with them is like, we want to make sure that the security team is plugged in with the architects inside the organization. with the leaders in the development community that might be thinking about that next framework, that next language, that next technology platform they're going to adopt. If security has visibility at the time when those technologies are being explored, never mind like after they've already been deployed and now we're trying to play catch up, that,
right.
then you can have a conversation right up front where as you are designing the use of these new technology platforms, the same time you can design all of these practices that we know lead to reduced time to fix these vulnerabilities. How do I automate if I'm going to use this technology stack? You know, how do I make sure that I have more frequent scanning and so on?
Yeah. Now, you know, the name of our show is Cyber Work, and we like to focus on the work of cybersecurity, not just the practice. So I'd love to talk, you know, have you talk to our listeners, many of whom are just starting their cybersecurity journey and maybe are watching this because they are interested in getting involved in AppSec or software development. How would you get started in application security in 2021? What are the sort of stepping stones that you would take now? Would you still, is computer science still a good starting point? Do you learn yourself? Do you just, where would you get started, do you think, if you were starting in 2021?
Good question. So I actually happen to think that we narrow the talent pool for ourselves in cybersecurity too much if we have an overemphasis on STEM. And I know that's, you know, you could say, well, you know, you had a bachelor's in computer science and a master's in computer science, so okay. But, you know, the first security company I joined, the CEO of that security company was a woman whose degree was in English. Mm-hmm. My predecessor at Veracode, I think his degree was in psychology, right? Mm-hmm. So I have clearly seen people that come out of the STEM field have incredibly successful careers inside cybersecurity. So the reason why I say, like, let's not overemphasize on STEM as a background is because we know that there's a talent shortage in cybersecurity. Then Absolutely. You overemphasize on STEM, you narrow the pool even further. What if we could broaden the types of backgrounds and domains and degree types we could attract into cybersecurity? The domain is something that can be taught over time, right? Because in any organization, you need great marketeers, you need great salespeople, you need, you know, people that are going to support the employees in that organization in a wonderful way. And you need great technologists that are going to develop really innovative technology. But it takes all of those pieces coming together. So I think that's an opportunity for us to say, if you have a degree in English, but you're interested in cybersecurity, maybe you can join in this particular role. And then right. if you want to go down a technical path, here's a training curriculum that we can put together that maybe moves you over to the technical path. Or maybe you want to stay in the path that you're in and have incredible contributions in security. So I just wanted to get that out there because
Absolutely.
I think that creates an opportunity for us to deal with this issue around talent shortage. You know, in terms of what you can do to get started is, I mean, there's a lot of great material that is out there. There are organizations like OWASP and, you know, Veracode has a community edition of our Security Labs capability, which is what trains developers on how to write secure code. It's a very hands-on way on how to write secure code and what kinds of vulnerabilities exist in code and so forth. So I think if you have an interest in this area, there's a lot of great information, great content in the public domain that you can go access and get yourself smart on. And then, you know, I'm willing to bet that every security company and every application security company on the planet has more roles than they can fill in their organizations.
Absolutely.
I know our customers have people that they're looking to bring on board in their teams, right? To manage their programs and so on. And even if you think you don't have the direct domain experience, like go find some role in, go apply for a role in a cybersecurity company or an application security company, even if it doesn't have to do exactly with the technology aspects of what that company does, gets your foot in the door. And if you demonstrate your desire to learn and, you know, you're fired up about this category and this space, then it gives you a place where you're going to be surrounded by other people that know this, that you can learn over time.
Yeah. Now, you know, we are always talking about the skills gap and the human resource gap and so forth. Can you talk about some common mistakes that candidates make in trying to apply for jobs in your department or vice versa? Can you talk about the ways that, you know, job listings are maybe sort of overwritten in ways that, you know, no one wants to apply for it because they feel like they're out of their depth. I think we hear so much about, you know, there this being this great disparity between, well, I couldn't ever do that. And they're like, why won't anyone apply to this? Anyone could do this, you know?
Right. Yeah. It's a great question. I think I'd go back to don't overamp either on the hiring side or the candidate side on technology requirements, the technical skill set and experience, whether you've done exactly that before or not. There are a lot of roles that we hire for at Veracode where I am not looking at exactly what your technical background is vis-a-vis application security. I'm actually looking at how good are you at communicating with customers? How good are you at communicating, period? How collaborative are you, right? How much out-of-the-box thinking can you do? When there are challenging issues, how do you handle yourself? Do you just persevere through it, or do you kind of give up, right? There are a lot of these aspects of how you do what you do that we pay attention to. Now, obviously, if I'm looking for a role in our security research team, I'm not going to hire someone that doesn't know how to do security research, right? So not every role is like that, but there are a lot of roles where you are looking at those aptitude areas more so than the actual domain knowledge. So I think as long as both the hiring side can have more flexibility and just open their minds more to those possibilities, and the candidates can do that as well in terms of like, yeah, why can't I go try for this, right?
Right.
I think we can address some of those problems. You know, I came across a chief information security officer for a state government one time. I had the opportunity to meet her at RSA, and her job just prior to that role, she was in PR. And I thought, that's not a bad background to have move into this role, because she focused a lot on communication and she focused a lot on, and she reported that being able to bring people together to drive consensus on complicated technical problems or complicated policy decisions around cybersecurity actually was a great benefit.
Yeah,
organization.
So at the CISO level, you're a lot of times you're doing sort of PR to the board, telling them what needs to change and so forth. Is that
everything that evangelizing, right? And getting everybody in the organization on board that security is not just security's job, is a big part of that job. So if you have a skill set that allows you to do that more effectively, you can be very successful.
Yeah. Now, in your bio, you noted that you've worked to bring more women and diverse candidates into the tech workforce, which is something we always like to talk about on here on the show, as well as working with the Working Mothers Organization. And I'd love to hear more about this. What are some effective ways to bring more women and diverse candidates, and diverse in many ways: sexual orientation, gender identity, neurodiversity, differently abled? What are some of the ways that you've seen that have been really exciting and really sort of like widened the field and brought more interesting, diverse candidates into the field?
Yeah, so I think you have to commit yourself to focusing on it, right?
Yep.
Because this is another one of these where you were describing earlier, Chris, like how come we don't have more people like this, and then you like overamp on those kinds of descriptions, and how come you don't have more people, right? Like you can get into that kind of a situation here as well. And so you could say, oh my gosh, like diversity is so hard to achieve. Can we really do it? And that can become a self-fulfilling prophecy. And then it stays hard to achieve, right? Mm-hmm. So I think part of it is committing to focus on it. So what are some of the ways in which we focused on it? You referenced in my intro that I'm on the board of trustees of MassDLC. That's an organization that has taken the topic of diversity and inclusion very seriously. Last year, a number of technology companies in Massachusetts came together and signed up to the social justice charter. Veracode did too, where we committed our organizations to do various kinds of practices in this area, tracking our data, sharing our data, providing charitable donations to organizations that were looking to further the representation of underrepresented minorities and diverse candidates in the technology industry. So, you know, that's something that we did from an organizational perspective. We do measure our data. So we look at it, you know, over a time period, we look at it on the basis of gender, we look at it on the basis of ethnicity. And even when we look at it and we say, gosh, we have to do better, the fact that we're looking at it creates those moments which says we have to keep doing better. Now, I'm proud to say that on our executive team, we are 40% female, right? So that's, I think, a bigger number than I've seen in the executive ranks of a lot of cybersecurity companies. So we're proud of that. And we want to make sure that that's reflected throughout the organization. We also have, we build it in at a grassroots level as well. So I described to you some things that we're doing organizationally, but we also have a diversity and inclusion team that's very active in doing events that raise awareness around certain aspects of this, right? We have hackathons that we do as part of our company culture. And a very important part of hackathon is raising funds for charities that our employees believe in. And the hackathon that we did late last year, Resilient Coders was an organization that we, you know, raised money for, where they try to get youth from Black communities, Latinx communities to get representation in technology. So, you know, those are things that we do. And then hiring. We work with our recruiters and say, look, we want to have a diverse slate. And, you know, like you make that clear to the recruiters upfront. So that there's their exploration process, their selection process can take that into account, and that you kind of force yourself and them to speak to a more diverse slate.
Yeah,
just kind of also talking about work and those parts. You know, you're kind of touching on company culture, that DEI is important at Veracode. I guess if you can just think more generally back to what we were discussing earlier in the conversation, was that you know, Veracode has maintained its edge, its innovative edge. And, you know, a lot of security companies, the return on capital hasn't been that great because they, you know, they created a solution to address a specific threat. And then, you know, it's something new comes along, the better mousetrap is invented. Like, can you talk about what about Veracode's culture has maintained that innovative edge over, you know, many years and, you know, through many different, you know, financial owners and all that? I'd be really curious to hear about that.
Yeah. So first of all, I think we picked a good problem, right, to solve. It's a big problem to solve. I mean, who doesn't have software? And there's a lot to be done around software security, especially as software keeps evolving. You were talking to me earlier about, you know, new platforms, new technologies coming out. So I think we picked a good area, right? So let's start with that. And then associated with that, what I found since I joined the company after Chris founded it in 2006 is that people are really passionate about our mission. Like, people really care about solving the software security problem. And there are so many moments in time in our history where that mission feels so, it takes on a life that's almost bigger than ourselves. And so as an example, last year, one of our customers in the healthcare space, we were helping them with some of their applications that were doing contact tracing for COVID, right? We were helping them with some applications that were subsequently going to support vaccine distributions in the United States. That makes you feel like you're connected to a big crisis that humanity was going through. Right. And you're serving to improve things for the world at large, right? So one thing that has served us well is that our team has that passion, and that we can connect the work that we do for our customers to that passion, right? So keeping that very much in the forefront of our minds as we have evolved as an organization. You know, we've been a private company, we were part of a public company, we're a private company again. We've gone through various revenue bands, valuation bands. But one thing that has stayed the same through that whole time is the passion that people have for this, which keeps people connected. And then I think the other thing is we find vulnerabilities and flaws for what we do. So one of the things that we're also always doing is constructive feedback to ourselves. So let's have the confidence of someone that is a leader, eighth time in a running in the Gartner Magic Quadrant, but let's also have the humility of someone that recognizes that it's always changing in technology. It's always changing in security. So never get too comfortable, never get too complacent, and just, you know, constantly be striving for more. I think those are philosophies that have held us well as we've gone through our various evolutions.
Yeah. Fantastic response there. I love that. Thank you.
So as we wrap up today, we're getting on the hour here, and this has been great, and you know, we could talk to you for hours and hours, but I want to send you on your way and not take up too much of your time. But you know, as we wrap up today, we see a lot of comments in our YouTube, you know, videos, and you know, obviously no one writes to you when things are going great, but you know, there's sometimes a lot of despair. I don't know where to start, or I'm stuck in my job, or, you know, I don't really know how to make that next step. Do you have any advice or recommendations for people who might feel like maybe they're in a help desk role, or they're in a particular area of cybersecurity that they feel isn't working out for them? Do you have any advice for people who want to sort of either get into cybersecurity after doing another thing, or push themselves into a new direction if they feel like they're on the wrong path at the moment?
So remember we talked earlier about how much shortage of talent and resources there is in this category. Absolutely. I'd remind everyone of that, because that is the opportunity for people, right? Like if you're feeling like I can't get into this space, no one's going to give me a shot, or, you know, I can't go beyond this level or what have you. You know, the advice that I would give them is make an attempt and ask for feedback if the answer is no. Like, okay, I get that I'm not ready right now, but what kinds of things do I need to know, do I need to demonstrate that will get me ready, right? Because then you show a growth mindset, you show initiative. And given how much dearth of talent there is and dearth of resources there is in our category, like maybe like right out the gate, you may not be there, but if you show a willingness to learn and you ask the question, right? There are so many opportunities in the sector that people can absolutely move forward and make progress. So it's about trying and learning.
That's great. All right, well, I think we're gonna end it on that. Jack, do you have any last thoughts or questions or anything you want to wrap on?
No, just thanks so much for being on the podcast. It was super informative, and I think our audience is really going to get a lot out of this one. So
thank you for having me. It was great chatting with both of you.
All right. I have one last question. It's incredibly challenging. It's for all the marbles. If our listeners want to know more about Veracode or Sam King, where can they go online?
I'd recommend people go to our website, veracode.com, where they can also see all of the job postings we have open for roles we're looking to fill.
All right. Sam, Jack, thank you so much for joining us today on CyberWork. This was so much fun.
Thank you for having me.
And as always, thank you to everyone who is listening today, either at home or at work from home. New episodes of the CyberWork podcast are available every Monday at 1 p.m. Central, both on video at our YouTube page and on audio wherever fine podcasts are downloaded. Thank you once again to Sam King of Veracode and Jack Koziel of InfoSec. And thank you all again for watching and listening. We'll talk to you next week. How about some free cybersecurity training resources for you and your team? Just go to infosecinstitute.com/free to get ebooks, training guides, and more than 100 cybersecurity training courses, all free for CyberWork listeners. Go to infosecinstitute.com/free and start learning crucial new skills today.